Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does China think? The newly prosperous nation may remain a one-party state, but by no definition is it still a place with just one point of view. And although strict rules exist for how and when dissent from the mainstream can be expressed, genuine political and ideological debate does exist in 21st century China, both on the street and in the corridors of major think tanks that are thriving in every major city there. For many, the debate centers around economic questions, including the extent to which China's burgeoning capitalism will be controlled by the government and what benefits it should provide for the citizens who power it. Mark Leonard is executive director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called, simply enough, What Does China Think? Mark, welcome to Think.
Hi.
You write that China's economic success in recent years has produced the confidence within the country to question the very system that created it. That's a really interesting paradox.
It's absolutely fascinating because we got used to thinking about China in terms of reformers or modernizers who wanted to move towards the market and conservatives who wanted to stick with the Marxist-Leninist political system and economic system which existed before that. And I think that was true certainly until the end of the 1980s. But what's happened now is that within the modernizers and reformers, there are two camps, very clear camps, which have emerged. One which is more or less on the right of the political spectrum. Their opponents call them the New Right, and they're the economists who are very influential in terms of China's embrace of the market. And they really want the state to shrivel away and to become no more than a body that's designed to protect property rights. And then on the other hand, there is a rising group of people who are known as the New Left, because they're new, because they're not like the old left that was against the market, but they're left because they care about the spiraling inequality and the destruction of the environment which has taken place in recent years' time. And that has led to quite a lively debate. And the differences between these camps are much bigger than the differences between, say, the Republicans and the Democrats in American politics.
Well, and what's so interesting about the New Right and the New Left in China is that they both continue to exist under a nominally communist government.
That's right. I mean, there are many paradoxes about China, but maybe one of the biggest paradoxes is that this is a nominally communist government that doesn't supply pensions to most of its citizens, doesn't supply free health care to most of its citizens, and in fact is much smaller than the national state, is much smaller than the state in many more capitalist countries than China. And that's one of the things which has led to a real questioning of the future direction of China, particularly by this new left group of people.
And at the same time, there are really interesting, what you call democratic experiments in democracy taking place in China these days. Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, there's also, I think, quite an interesting debate about what model of political reform China should adopt. If you went back to China in the 1980s, again, in the same way that most Chinese in the 80s who were reformers wanted to embrace the market in an uncomplicated sense. In the 1980s, most people who wanted political reform wanted to go towards a Western liberal democratic model. You know, they'd argue about whether they wanted a presidential system like the United States or a parliamentary system like the United Kingdom. But now, increasingly, there are people who are questioning that. That's not just because after Tiananmen Square, a lot of the people who wanted liberal political reforms were put in prison or ended up in exile. It's also a result of the self-confidence that's come with the economic growth that China's seen. And I think there are two kind of interesting groups of thinkers that are emerging. One group that calls for what they call incremental democracy. And what they mean is that you should gradually start with experiments in political reform at a local level, either elections in villages or in townships or within the party itself, and that this could gradually over a long period of time work its way up to the top of Chinese politics. But there are other people who say that actually the last thing China needs is elections. What it needs instead is the rule of law and a one-party state that's in touch with public opinion, and they're trying to find ways of putting it in touch with public opinion, either through using opinion polls, through using focus groups, or even, most interestingly, using forms of public consultation. So actually taking big decisions about issues which matter to ordinary people to the public and allowing them to debate them and to argue about them, and then making the authorities take those views into account when they make actual decisions. And that's leading to what I call a form of deliberative dictatorship. It's a kind of Darwinian dictatorship that it is able to stay abreast of what the public want.
That's a very interesting system, because to us in the West, that sounds like something that would never work, that would be really easily corruptible. But based on what exists now in China, it almost sounds as if that might work better initially.
I'm not sure if it will work better, but it certainly means that the thing which has ended a lot of one-party states, the fact that the government became increasingly out of touch with what the public wanted, is less likely to happen in the short term in China and will take longer. And it could mean that China's one-party system proves to be much more resilient than a lot of the critics think. And I think it also shows how, it goes back to your original point, that because we've often thought that reform in China would mean that people would become more like us, a lot of people have missed the big, deep-rooted changes that have taken place to China's politics. People often assume that the economy has been completely revolutionized, that it's gone from a central planning system to a market economy, but that the politics has been kept in a sort of deep freeze and hasn't changed. Because in fact, the political system is almost as different from the communist system that took place before these reforms started. But people haven't noticed these differences because they haven't been going in the direction of democracy. It's been about making the one-party state more effective, more professional, and giving it better access to information.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Mark Leonard. He's Executive Director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called What Does China Think? Can you talk about the think tank community that exists in China these days?
Sure. One of the things which came as a real surprise to me the very first time I went to China was just how many people working away in think tanks, in universities, and how vast the community is. The first think tank I went to is called the Chinese Academy of Social Science, and it's based in Beijing. And I remember almost falling off my chair when the director told me that there were 4,000 researchers there spread in 260 different centers, and that they published, dozens of journals. And that's just one out of a dozen think tanks in Beijing alone, and all of the big cities have got their own think tanks. And what's interesting when you go inside them is obviously not all of these 4,000 researchers are up to sort of, first-class international standards. But outside of Washington, it's probably the biggest and most lively think tank community that I've come across in the world. And the arguments which they're having are about really big issues. Now, as you said in your intro, it's not a free society. There are some topics that are off bounds. Nobody talks about the overthrow of the Communist Party. No one talks about the independence of Tibet. But nevertheless, within the areas where there are arguments, the differences are really quite massive between the new left and the new right, between people who want to have a political reforms based around incremental spread of elections and those who are in favor of this deliberative dictatorship model. And in foreign policy, the differences are even bigger between people who basically think that China should rejoin and become part of the international system as it stands at the moment and to fight for a bigger place within it, and people who look a bit more like the sort of Chinese cousins of the neoconservatives here. I call them the neocons because their goal is really to try and overthrow Western dominance. It's an old kind of Maoist goal, which is being pursued in very, very novel and innovative ways at the moment.
What's the relationship between think tanks, Mark, and the officials who actually have the power to make decisions and craft public policy?
Well, most of these think tanks are financed by the government. I mean, some of them get private funding as well. They have a very porous relationship with the government. So a lot of the people that I met and interviewed have done briefings for people, including at the very highest levels of Chinese government, including the president and the prime minister, various committees of the Politburo. So they're part of the political system in a way, and sometimes ideas which they develop are taken forward by the political system. Sometimes they're asked to work up ideas which the political leaders have and give them greater depth and policy focus. So there is a sort of there is a porous relationship between the intellectual communities and the centers of power. And if, in many ways, actually, I think the authorities are quite happy to use the think tanks and the universities and the journals to put ideas in play and also to be able to cherry pick from existing ideas. Because what you have, if you look at the Chinese government now, is a very pragmatic, very results-orientated government that isn't any longer governed by any strong ideology. And therefore, they are willing to experiment with all sorts of different ideas. And the way that China works is it is like a giant laboratory. So most ideas do get tested out somewhere. It might be at a local level. It might just be at the level of villages. But it is very interesting to see how willing they are to try different ideas out and if they work to spread them more widely. And in fact, that's how China embraced the market at the beginning. It didn't go from an economy where the prices were set by the government to one where they were set by market activities in one fell swoop. What they did was they created a whole series of special economic zones where market ideas could be tested out beforehand without undermining the centrally planned economy.
Are there direct relationships between these think tanks and business and industry, or does it all continue to filter through the government?
Well, I mean, in China, there's not a clear distinction between the government and business and industry, given partly because a lot of the biggest companies are still owned by the state. Even companies that have been privatized are linked by sort of shadowy networks to people within the party. And the party is present in all aspects of society. Most of the big business leaders are party members. So there are definitely links. And in fact, some of the centers in the think tanks are funded by Chinese entrepreneurs as well.
You talked about certain issues continuing to be off limits, at least for public discussion by members of think tanks and others. Are there thinkers in China who define human rights in a manner that is any way similar to what we in the West would consider human rights?
There certainly are. There's some very, very brave activists who not only define it in that way, but are willing to take the authorities to court and to stand up for people at a local level. There is a sort of increasingly large civil society that's organized, particularly in the environmental sector, but in other areas as well. And there are people who fight very strongly for the rights of individual workers as well. But I mean, my book is less focused on the dissidents and on the people outside of the system than trying to understand the thinking of people who are within the system. And they tend to, I mean, they will talk about human rights. You know, it is interesting that there are more and more lawyers who are trained every year within China. And a lot of the problems which the government is trying to deal with are a result of increasing social unrest. You know, the fact that there were, I think, 86,000-87,000 protests last year on the streets, which were a lot of them were due to some of them were due to environmental disasters. Some of them were due to people being laid off without being given proper compensation. Some of them were about people having their land confiscated and not having proper legal recourse. So a lot of these are human rights related, but they do tend to be issues where human rights crosses over into economic rights.
So it causes a pragmatic problem for the government, if nothing else.
Yes.
Mark Leonard is my guest. He's executive director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called What Does China Think? You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. After the break, we'll talk about the relationship between China and Africa.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Executive Director of the European Council on Foreign Relations, Mark Leonard. His new book is called What Does China Think? You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. How much power does China have to influence the development of Africa?
Well, it has increasingly large amounts of power, both through its own example, because African countries look at this incredible model of economic growth, which has taken hundreds of millions of people out of agricultural backwardness into the middle class in just 30 years' time, and more people than the whole population of Europe at the time of industrialization have gone through that process in China. But also because China is becoming an increasingly important actor in Africa. And one of the incredible things to have happened recently was the opening by the Chinese government of a series of special economic zones in Africa. As we were talking earlier about how China itself embraced the market, and one of the secrets of China's own economic development was the creation of a series of special economic zones. Shenzhen was the first one and the most famous one, which was this small fishing village which turned into a kind of model of Chinese capitalism. And these special economic zones were allowed to implement market ideas. They were given tax breaks, and they built shipping and road links between them and the rest of China and the rest of the world, which allowed them to export their produce. And what's amazing is that last year, Hu Jintao went to Zambia and opened the first Chinese special economic zone in Africa. And it's literally transplanting the Chinese economic model into another continent. And they're going to build another four special economic zones in the near future. They're going to build a shipping hub. So the first one was a minerals hub in Zambia. The second one will be a shipping hub in Mauritius. And the third one will be in Dar es Salaam. And there's a competition between a series of African countries for the other two slots. And what's amazing about this is, one, that African countries are scrambling to be selected for these special economic zones in the same way that Central and Eastern European countries desperately tried to get into the European Union when communism fell in the 1990s. Africans are trying to get these Chinese special economic zones. And in those zones, what you see is the basic model of Chinese capitalism which is being implemented, which is very different from the model of the Washington Consensus.
In terms of places like Sudan and Myanmar and Zimbabwe, you write that despite the pressure that's placed on them by the West, China will never be supportive of multi-party elections and human rights because at this point they're not giving those things to their own citizens. Is there a kind of pressure that is effective if the West wants China to change the way it deals with these countries and its expectations for the way they deal with their own citizens?
Yeah, I mean, I think China is probably the most self-aware rising power in history. It's desperate not to be seen as a threat by the rest of the world. It's desperate to avoid being in a position where its neighbors link up with each other and with the United States to try and contain China's rise. So for that reason, Chinese are obsessed with soft power, with China's image, with not being seen as a threat, and they will make shifts if real pressure is put on them over specific issues. And we saw that over Sudan, for example, where there had been a lot of attention on the role that China's played in bankrolling the genocide in Darfur, supplying weapons to the Sudanese state, but also providing the Sudanese government with protection on the UN Security Council and blocking various resolutions to help send peacekeepers into Darfur. And as a result of big international pressure, led in particular by Mia Farrow, but which came to a head when Steven Spielberg pulled out of his role in the Olympic Games, China has made a series of tactical shifts, and it appointed an envoy to deal with Sudan. It supported the deployment of a UN force when it was chairing the Security Council, and showed that it was willing to do just enough to make sure that it wasn't seen as on the wrong side of history. But it's not doing this because it's a great believer in human rights and democracy for the Sudanese people. It's more to avoid being seen as a pariah in the West. Similar things have happened in Zimbabwe, for example, where China played an important role in propping up Mugabe in the past, providing him with weapons, with surveillance equipment, and with a degree of political support. But when it became clear that this was going to prevent China, well, there was going to be a price in terms of Chinese legitimacy in the West, but also that Mugabe himself was probably going to collapse anyway, the Chinese government did shift its position on it. And I think they don't want to be seen as leading a kind of loser coalition of repressive governments around the world. So they are quite pragmatic, and they'll weigh up their support for particular regimes. But it is also true that as China becomes an increasingly important player in the world, a lot of the market opportunities are in countries that the West is trying to isolate. And that's why you see big Chinese investments in places like Sudan, Iran, Zimbabwe, Burma, places which have problematic human rights situations, dangerous, difficult regimes, and countries which the West was trying to influence by isolating them. And now they have another option. The choice is not between isolation and doing what the West tells them to do. There is now a Chinese option as well.
Is there a possibility that Africa will become simply more like China?
I think that's already happening in economic terms. I mean, not just Africa. I think if you look at around the world, the Chinese model isn't that attractive to the US or to developed countries in Western Europe or in Japan or in Canada. But in Africa, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, in Latin America, people are more and more talking about the Chinese model. And you see how countries that in the 90s were embracing the Washington consensus, were doing what Western development agencies told them to do, have suddenly reversed their policies and actually looking much more to China for inspiration. They've stopped privatizing large chunks of their economy and, in fact, started nationalizing them. They have state-led industrial policies. There are now 3,000 special economic zones in the world that are explicitly modeled on the Chinese model. So I think that is increasingly starting to happen. And a lot of people in the developing world are excited that there is this new great superpower on the world stage that isn't Western and that doesn't lecture them in the way that Western countries have done in the past.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Mark Leonard is my guest. His new book is called What Does China Think? Let's speak to Adrian in Dallas. Hi, Adrian.
Hi. Very interesting conversation and very necessary. I would like to know if your guest would agree that, you know, you yourself, Chris, made a comment earlier that they are not pushing for human rights because they don't really give human rights to its citizens. Is it possible that they decide to use soft power, which was discussed before, because they are simply intelligent enough to realize that soft power, without any conditions on any of the help or aid they provide to other countries, is more efficient than the hard power that we use, this country? And that's the reason why they choose to do that. Not because, you know, they realize, oh, we're not providing enough human rights for our people, so therefore we cannot demand from other countries.
Mark, what do you think?
I think it's definitely true that the Chinese government is very pragmatic, that they will, as I said earlier, they'll try anything out that works. And one of the things that works at the moment is almost being seen as a mirror image of the United States. So if you look at Chinese public diplomacy and if you look at the reason why China is more popular, certainly with a lot of developing governments at the moment, is that it explicitly tries to be the mirror image of the U.S. They say where the United States is unilateral, we believe in multilateral institutions. Where the United States doesn't obey international law, we believe in the United Nations and international law. Where the United States tries to attach conditions to its loans, we don't make those sorts of demands. And, you know, some of this is just rhetoric and is hypocritical, but some of it is having an impact on in different parts of the world, because obviously America's soft power has taken a hit since the Iraq war and with the unilateralism of the Bush administration. And the Chinese have been probably the biggest beneficiaries of that.
So it's come up a couple of times in different ways. The fact that the Chinese government as it exists today is really sort of based on pragmatic decision-making, no particular ideology. Do you think, Mark, that there are particular vulnerabilities for a government of an entire country, an enormous one at that, without any kind of ideological or moral foundation to the way it's run?
I think that's definitely a danger, because if you don't have a moral or an ideological foundation, then the only way of winning the loyalty of your citizens is to show that you're improving their lives. And for the last 30 years, you know, the sheer numbers of China's economic growth have allowed them to make quite impressive claims about how they've improved people's lives. And for an ordinary citizen, even though there hasn't been a massive expansion in political freedom, the kind of freedom of people's everyday lives has grown enormously. You know, if you go back just 10 years, you needed to ask your party secretary's permission to get married, for example. I mean, those sorts of intrusions in people's everyday lives have a lot of them have disappeared. People's standard of living has, for hundreds of millions of people, the standard of living has improved immeasurably. And there are lots of consumer products in China which were there beforehand. So that does generate some legitimacy for the government. Also, the fact that this is the first period in Chinese history for a long time where there hasn't been major chaos and political unrest, and the country hasn't been in sort of danger of breaking up, that also creates some credit for the governing party. But I think in the future they realise that they need to do more than that, and that I think is one of the things which is driving a shift towards the left in terms of the rhetoric of China's political leaders, but also the power of the ideas of the left is growing, because they realize that one of their vulnerabilities is that whilst hundreds of millions of people have benefited from the growth of the last 30 years, an even larger number of people haven't benefited. And China's gone from being one of the most unequal countries in the world. Sorry, from one of the most equal countries in the world to one of the most unequal countries in the world.
Everyone was equally poor before.
Exactly, everyone was equally poor. Now there are some super rich. There are some billionaires in China, but there are also hundreds of millions of people who are poorer than even the poorest in Africa. And I think that part of what's happening at the moment is through these debates that we've been talking about, there is the kind of development of what could be seen as a China model, which is in a way a sort of a direct challenge to the sort of flat world idea of globalization, where and the idea is of a different kind of capitalism where the state plays a bigger role, which is more able to deliver for people's everyday lives, a political system that is in touch with public opinion, but that sees stability as more important than anything else, and therefore issues and avoids elections, and in the foreign policy realm, a world order that protects the rights of states not to be interfered with. And I think, you know, there is a kind of Chinese worldview that's crystallizing there, which does have some legitimacy at home, and which might provide some kind of moral cloak for the pragmatic actions of the Chinese government, it doesn't mean that they have to look back to Marx or to Confucius or Mao in order to legitimate their decisions.
Mark Leonard is my guest. He's executive director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called What Does China Think? Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Next on the line, we have Charles in Lakewood. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Mark, two questions. We hear repeated stories of draconian persecution by China against Falun Gong and against the burgeoning Christian fundamentalist home church movement. And number two, what is the difference between the European Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute of International Affairs?
Well, I mean, on your first question, I think it's definitely a major problem within China, the lack of religious freedom, and also just the general fear which the authorities have of people coming together and associating with each other in any form. And I mean, that's partly a product of Chinese history, where secret societies and sects have at various points managed to develop political power and have been able to overthrow the system. But there is a permanent sense of paranoia about the the Communist Party's hold on power. And that's the reason why they've cracked down so hard on the Falun Gong, which to many Westerners looks like a pretty harmless religious organization whose main activities seem to involve, you know, meditation and vegetarianism. But for China, it is a perpetual threat for the authorities that people will come together and overthrow them, and they deal pretty brutally with these perceived threats. Your second question, I mean, we're just different organizations. I mean, the Royal Institute for International Affairs is a British think tank which was founded at the same time as the American Council on Foreign Relations, and it's based in London. The European Council on Foreign Relations is a brand new institution which we launched in the fall of last year, and it's meant to be the first pan-European think tank. We've got offices in five different European countries already, in London, Paris, Madrid, Berlin, and Sofia. And we work on a whole series of different issues, on Asia, on Russia, on the Middle East, on transatlantic relations.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We can take a quick question before the break, and that comes from Dimitri in Louisville. Hi, Dimitri.
Hi. I wanted to ask the guest, from his conversations and his experience with these think tanks, what does he see is the kind of biggest short-term obstacle facing the Chinese government? Is it large latent workforces in the state-owned enterprises, or energy concerns, or migrant populations? Just what are they kind of focusing on the most?
Thanks for your call. We may be able to take part of the answer now and part after the break, Mark, but you can go ahead and start.
Well, I mean, all of the above. I mean, it is absolutely terrifying when you go in and talk to Chinese officials about their country. You know, within a few minutes, they'll give you a list of pressing problems, which is so long that it would terrify any elected official in the West. But they seem to be very aware of these things, and as I said, very pragmatic about finding solutions to them. But it's a whole mix of social and economic problems which they're facing at the moment.
Mark Leonard is my guest. He is executive director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called What Does China Think? You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mark Leonard. He's executive director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called What Does China Think? If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Mark, for me, one of the most fascinating revelations of the book is this idea that just as the West is planning for the rise of China in the 21st century, you have Chinese thinkers talking about how to manage the decline of the West. What issues are on their minds?
Well, it's not something they like talking about very much, but occasionally it does come into the open. I mean, it was sort of interesting how for many, many years Chinese thinkers were almost not able to use the word rise, as in the rise of China. It's like a taboo word, partly because the authorities thought that if China didn't talk about its rise, the West of the world might not notice that it was happening. But occasionally there are articles and public debates about the decline of the West and how China can manage it. And there was a very interesting debate a couple of years ago in a newspaper called the Global Times, which is linked to the People's Daily, the main Communist Party's newspaper, which was sparked by an article by a young scholar called, had the provocative title, How Can We Prevent the USA from Declining Too Quickly? And they basically argued that the U.S. provides a lot of public goods, you know, stability, deals with issues like proliferation, and that having the U.S. playing that role allows China to concentrate on its own growth without having to get too heavily involved in the problems of running the world. But that following the Iraq War, U.S. power was declining very quickly, and he was worried that it was happening too quickly for Beijing, which isn't quite ready for prime time yet. What was very interesting about this piece was there was a serious assessment of how the U.S. is playing this positive role in the world, and there was a debate with various scholars about how you could handle the U.S. in this period of decline. And the policies they came up with are almost the kind of mirror image of the policies which American China hands advocate for dealing with Beijing. And they said that you needed to have a mix of engagement and containment so that you could shape the United States into being the kind of power that you want, a responsible power which delivers these goods but doesn't stop China from rising. In many ways, that was the exact mirror image of what American China hands say about China itself. But it's also quite a useful and startling reminder that our debate about managing China's rise is maybe a little optimistic, because we often think that it's up to us to shape China rather than something which is going to happen largely according to a Chinese playbook rather than what Western policymakers want to do. But also just showed how kind of serious the debates are about China's rise and how much more self-aware China is as a rising power than other rising powers have been in the past. I mean, there's no comparison between the sort of maturity and the caution which Chinese strategists are showing with the attitudes of, say, Germany and Japan when they were rising, or even the United States, which was much less prepared for becoming a global superpower than China is at the moment.
Well, and meanwhile, when it comes to international relations, China has very often taken rather conciliatory positions within the UN. Is that, again, part of that strategy to sort of stay under the radar while they're continuing to strengthen?
Absolutely. I mean, it is something which is starting to shift as China becomes more self-confident and also more exposed in different parts of the world. But if you compare Chinese and Russian behavior at the United Nations, it's a very telling contrast. The Russians are delighted that they're back after the collapse of Russian power at the end of the Cold War. And they're therefore a very obstructive. They take great pleasure in thwarting Western plans within the UN. You get loud and obnoxious speeches by Russian diplomats and ministers and by the Russian president, whereas the Chinese tend to be very quiet. If there are measures which they don't like, they will first of all see if they can get other countries to kill them off for them, either hiding behind the Russians or getting European countries or African countries to stand in the way. And it's only as a last resort that they will actually block things themselves. And this stance has been devastatingly effective. If you look at votes on subjects like human rights within the United Nations, for example, you've seen there has been an absolutely dramatic shift in power. So if you go back 5 years ago, the United States was winning about 57% of the votes. I think it's not the exact figure, but now it's down to 22%. And China has rocketed from winning about half the votes to winning almost 80% of the votes.
So participating in 80% of the votes it participates in go its way.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Fred in Fort Worth. Hi, Fred.
Hey, hi. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Good. I have a question for your guest. I'm from West Africa. Hey, how you doing?
Mm-hmm. Fine.
Good.
Fred, you need to turn off your radio.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, now continue.
I have a question for your guest. I'm from West Africa, and I'm a product of independence. I remember quite well when I was growing up in Ghana, when I was very young. We had the infusion of the Soviet Union economic ideology. That's during the Cold War. What is China going to do different from what the Soviet Union did, you know, with their new economic ideology that is giving us, the same piece of good hope that the Soviet Union gave us, and nothing happened.
I think there are two main differences between China and the Soviet Union. One is the fact that the economic model which the Chinese are offering is not about socialism or communism. It is, in fact, it is capitalism. It's just a different kind of capitalism, which has got a much larger role for the state than Western capitalism has. But it does have a proven record of success in China over the last 30 years. It is about using markets to generate wealth rather than central planning. The second thing, which is maybe even more surprising, is that China is pouring very, very large resources into building up Africa's infrastructure. And when I talk to African analysts, I mean, they say that if you look at the number of roads and railways and ports and other very, very important bits of infrastructure which China's been building, they are more impressive even than the sort of infrastructure that colonial powers like Britain and France were building at the very height of the colonization of Africa. And that is something which is quite dramatic, and it's something which Western donors and international agencies were not doing.
To what extent, Mark, do you think that the Chinese model of economic expansion is really a response to against the cult of the USA, which sort of happened there after the Cultural Revolution?
I think that the new model that's emerging is an attempt to free China from the cult of the USA. I mean, Chinese thinkers talk about what they call a second liberation of thought. I mean, for them, the first liberation of thought was when China freed itself from the Maoist-Leninist system of government at the end of the 1970s, the beginning of the 1980s. And they're now arguing that having thrown off one ideology, which was communism, that China instead started worshipping at another shrine, the shrine of the United States and the neoliberal economics. And that they now need to throw that off and start thinking for themselves and to develop an indigenous Chinese model of development that takes the best ideas from the rest of the world and mixes them with Chinese ideas. And that really, I think, is what's starting to come out of these debates that we're going at the moment. It's not like they've developed a brand new Chinese model out of nothing. But I think as these debates go on, what you are seeing is certain themes which are crystallizing into a definite Chinese model, which poses a direct challenge, I think, certainly at an intellectual level, both to the American model and to the European model.
Do you anticipate a liberalization of the things that Chinese people are allowed to look at on the internet or read in the media? Is that something that the Chinese government can prevent, or is it something that they have to continue in order to keep the amount of control they have?
Well, I mean, what's interesting about the internet was this was one of the things that the West predicted would fundamentally change China. Was in fact, what's happened in the event is that China has probably done as much to change the internet as the internet has done to change China. Most Chinese people don't have access to the internet, but there are lots of people who do. And for those who do, they can get access to most things on the internet. The amount of content that is blocked out is, it's not a massive portion of it. So they zone in on particularly politically sensitive issues. But what they're particularly good at doing is trying to stop the Chinese turning the internet into a massive meeting ground. Because we talked earlier about how they're paranoid about Chinese people meeting up and organizing themselves against the state, which is why they stop trade unions from being independent trade unions from being formed. They're very suspicious of religions, and they're absolutely desperate to make sure that the internet doesn't become a kind of giant virtual meeting ground where people can get together and try and foment revolt, which is why the China will continue, I think, to have a very large internet police. They'll continue to have the Great Firewall of China, which filters internet traffic in and out of the country. But that's not the same from building a great wall which completely shuts China off from the rest of the world. I mean, it's interesting to see how much more contact with Western ideas and with Western culture the Chinese have than their Russian counterparts did during the Cold War.
We have an email from BB who asks, how can world leaders improve human and civil rights in regard to the 2008 Olympics and the Tibetan negotiations?
I mean, I think, if everything that I've been saying is right, I think there is a limit to the amount of influence that the outside world can have on internal developments within China. I mean, I think whether China becomes a democracy or not will depend to a large extent on developments within China, on how the Chinese people react to their country's future political development, what role the Communist Party plays itself. But that being said, I do think that the West can have some influence on Chinese behavior, because China is keen not to be seen as a threat. And that's why it is very important that Western leaders are not afraid to speak out about human rights abuses, both within China, but also in countries that are supported by the Chinese, such as in the situation in Darfur, in Burma, in other parts of the world. I think it's very important to hold the Chinese government to account for what it's doing in different parts of the world. And I also think, just for our own moral integrity, it is important that Western governments are not afraid to criticize large countries as well as small countries. It will look very hypocritical if they're only willing to talk out about human rights abuses in the smallest and the weakest countries and say nothing about the repression within China. So for those reasons as well, I think it's important to talk out about it. In terms of the Olympics itself, I mean, I think that think it is right for Western countries to put the question of whether they attend the opening ceremony of the Olympics on the table, and to hold out the prospect of a boycott if China doesn't behave in the right way. But I think it would be really also important for Western governments, in order to maximize their impact, to agree on a set of deliverable demands which they could individually drive home to the Chinese. And I think one thing which would be important would be to ensure that the media blackout in Tibet is lifted, so that we have some sense of what's going on there. And also to keep up the pressure on the Chinese authorities to have meaningful engagement with the Dalai Lama.
Very briefly, in the seconds we have left, is there any reason for the West to fear the China that we see emerging today?
I think it is going to become a big intellectual competitor to the West. It's going to mean that Western governments have to fight much harder to promote the things that we hold dearest in the world, whether it's democracy, human rights, liberal model of capitalism. But for those reasons, I think it is a big challenge. But for the hundreds of millions of people who live in China and who are being brought out of poverty, China's development is a real boon, and I think that as human beings we should support that and be happy that many people are going to have a far better life than their parents and their grandparents have.
Mark Leonard is Executive Director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called What Does China Think? Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.